How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily podcast on the Oklahoma City Thunder, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello there, everyone. We're locking in for episode 126 of Locked On Thunder, presented by the Norman Transcript. I'm your host, Fred Katz. Locked On Thunder is part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Head on to iTunes and search Locked On Thunder to subscribe to the podcast there. Leave a review once you're on that page if you're feeling comfortable doing that as well. And you can log on to normantranscript.com and check out my blog, Thunder Road. It's under the sports tab on the site. You can find all your Thunder needs there. It's Warriors Day, and joining me on Warriors Day is Locked On Warriors host, Danny LaRue. Danny, what's happening?
Not a whole lot. I just got back from the groundbreaking ceremony for the Warriors' new arena, which will be in San Francisco in a couple of years. So East Bay fans are feeling heartbreak related to the Warriors that maybe is more similar to what your fan base felt a few months ago. I'm just such
I'm trolling all my listeners.
Well, I trolled Cavs fans last night because I enjoy that. And so I figured, why not just keep it going? And I love the wonderful people of Oklahoma City. I spent a wonderful 5 days there. So good humor is only meant for those that I appreciate.
All right. So Wednesday night, Thunder Warriors. It's a thing again. We went like 2 months without it being a thing. We were so close. We're so close to it not being a thing anymore. Now it's kind of a thing. There's kind of less hype around this game now, right? Like I'm surprised by there being such little. Maybe I'm just kind of in my own vacuum.
Okay, I feel like I want to take this time to express frustration with the way that the league approaches these sorts of things, that they sometimes wait too long for the return game. And I don't mean the return game meaning Oklahoma City coming back to Oakland. Durant in Oklahoma City hasn't even happened yet. It lost a lot of its sizzle, not only by not happening early, but by being supplanted by two other games between these two teams.
I'm with you. When the schedule came out, I didn't know why the first game wasn't in Oklahoma City. And I didn't know why they waited till February 11th for the Kevin Durant to Oklahoma City return game. I didn't get it then. And you know what? I thought that this storyline was going to carry on all year. Like, I thought that, like, the dialogue all year was going to be about Kevin Durant. And it hasn't been that. I mean, from the Thunder perspective, of course. And it hasn't really been that. It's actually less intense, I think, than I even expected it to be. It's died out even more than I thought. It's not like it's dead or anything, but it's died out even more than I thought it would. And that game is, it's obviously going to be a big game, and people in Oklahoma are going to be pumped for it. And the crowd that night is probably going to be the best crowd of any game I've ever been to. I just, like, wouldn't at all be surprised if that were the case, especially during, like, intros and that kind of stuff, especially if it's a close game or something like that. That is going to be a rowdy crowd. It's going to be insane. I'm excited to go to it, but, like, the hype around that game leading up to it, it's not going to be the same as if it were played in, like, November.
I believe a highly esteemed local columnist attributed some of that as being one of the larger accomplishments of Russell Westbrook's season, is that the Durant story has not permeated the entirety of this Oklahoma City year, and I for one am thankful for it.
That's like the nicest thing you've ever said to me, calling me highly esteemed. I've never been highly esteemed. I might be in some circles respected, but I don't think I'm highly esteemed.
At least you're well liked, so that's something you have over me.
Yeah, well, you're not helping your likability by coming over and trashing the Thunder on a Thunder podcast. Well,
that is not what I did. I just was stirring the pot a little bit. I mean, I still think, as great as Oracle fans are, and they are, The crowd at games 3 and 4 of the Western Conference Finals, which I covered in person, were two of the best crowds that I've ever experienced in person.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was amazing. You know what? Actually, that was not the best Thunder crowd that I've experienced in my less than a year covering the Thunder. The best Thunder crowd that I've experienced was game 6 of the Spurs Western Conference semis. There was something about the loudest I've ever heard in an arena or a stadium or anything in my entire life was when Kevin Durant hit a 3 to put the Thunder up like 20 or 21 or whatever it was in the first half in game 6 against San Antonio. Oh my goodness. It got so loud. I was sitting next to, you know, Barry Trammell?
Loosely, yes.
So Barry's like the best. He's just the nicest guy. And I sat next to Barry that game. And Durant, when he hit that 3, it got so loud. And I leaned over to Barry and I was like, I leaned over to say to him, it's so loud. And I screamed in his ear, it's so loud. And he actually not only did he not hear me, he didn't even know I was like screaming in his ear. Like he wasn't even aware that I was right next to his face screaming in his ear. It was so loud. It's not like he could hear me, but it was like muffled. Like he didn't even know that I was screaming next to him. It was so loud. That was a crazy moment.
Well, that ties in actually with something, because that was a clinch game, correct?
Yeah, that was the game that closed out the series.
The Warriors had a similar thing. The loudest I ever heard an Oracle crowd was when they clinched the series against the Nuggets back in 2013. And the Warriors actually haven't had that many clinch series. They didn't win the title in Oakland. They won, I believe, one of the conference finals in Oakland. And that is a very different thing. When you know we're moving on, we beat this team, especially when it was a hard-fought series, which, of course, Thunder Spurs was last year. And it was an emotionally resonant moment for them. I understand why that takes on a different thing. That's what the Nugget series was for the Warriors. It was, we've made a significant step as an organization.
Yeah, I totally buy that. I remember that. That was a fun series, too, that Warriors-Nugget series. That was a really fun series. I want to talk a little bit about this actual game, because there is a basketball game. Like, I don't know what you alluded to that I wrote about. Like, it's funny, because Russell Westbrook has been so good this year that the prevailing Thunder story this year is not necessarily Kevin Durant. It's, holy crap, Russell Westbrook is averaging a triple-double. And, like, what's Russell, whether a positive or a negative, it's what's Russell Westbrook going to do tonight? So let's talk a little bit about what the Thunder are going to do on Wednesday night. Warriors are 35-6. They're pacing to win a lowly, just unbelievably horrible 70 games. Danny, what happened to them?
They lost Harrison Barnes. That's what happened.
Awful. Awful. 70 games. They have a higher net rating than they did last year. They're plus minus through 41 games. They're outscoring opponents by more through 41 games than they were through 41 games last year. So they've been okay. They've been doing all right. Except against, I guess, the Spurs, Memphis, Houston, and who's the other one who they haven't beaten that everyone talks about?
Oh, the other team that they haven't beaten.
Cleveland. I guess they beat Cleveland, so now it's a thing. That was the dumbest. That was one of the dumbest things. I guess that's over now. I didn't even think about that because they beat Cleveland on Monday. That was one of the dumbest things to me. When people be like, well, the Spurs haven't beaten Cleveland, Memphis, San Antonio, Houston, and Memphis. So they got to prove it against the top teams. That was ridiculous.
It's even more ridiculous when the team in question has a track record. Like, it's something very different when a team as an organization hasn't reached a certain threshold. Like, let's say the Clippers not making the conference finals or the NBA finals. You know, if you get there, that's something different. The Warriors won an NBA championship over Cleveland. So anything on that note is strange. I get that there are always times that you're scrambling for narratives, but for me, you can focus on the basketball between those two teams and also these two teams. And a question I wanted to ask you, considering the Clippers game last night, is how do you think the Thunder are going to approach this game in terms of their big men with Steven Adams flying back to Oklahoma?
Yeah, so last time Enes Kanter played only 4 games against the Warriors. That is like, you know, I don't think that's going to happen this time. But at the same time, like LaVerne Canner, those guys, like, don't match up well with the Warriors on the defensive end. Now, Canner's been playing great lately, and they're going to need his offense. I think you might see a ton of minutes out of Jeremy Grant. Last time they played with Grant, Grant was, you know, it was his second day ever with the Thunder. He hadn't had a practice. He came over the morning of the Clippers game on November 2nd. He played in the Clippers game that night. Then the next night they played the Warriors on the second night of a back-to-back. I think you might see a lot of minutes out of Jeremy Grant. He played like 15 or the first 16 minutes or something like that of the Clippers game. I think if it weren't a blowout, there's a chance he might have played like 40 minutes in that game. But Donovan used him to start because he wanted to switch him on pick and rolls and that kind of stuff. And he wanted to have a defensive presence out there and keep Canner in that same role against the Clippers. I have a feeling, I don't know this for sure, I have a feeling he's going to do the same thing this time. I don't know if it's necessarily going to work, but I have a feeling he's going to do the same thing. But maybe Grant just plays like 40 minutes or something in this game.
He could. I would be excited to see it just because he adds a different dimension. And if they're actually playing him at power forward or center, that's a lot closer to his ideal role. And I've advocated for that basically since they acquired him. So anything that gets them in that direction, I mean, obviously you don't want Steven Adams to be hurt. I'm a huge fan of his, but it's still an encouraging part of this.
What do you think of Grant as a player? Like, what do you think? What do you think Jeremy Grant in like 10 years is going to be? Like, we look back on Jeremy Grant's career 10 years from now, but like, this is what Jeremy Grant's career has been.
An intriguing and somewhat popular role player who you always wonder if he could have been more. And I would love for him to be more than that, but his lack of a jump shot is a concern. And also that he doesn't have the perfect physical skill set to be a straight four, just because physically he's a little bit less strong than you'd want, but I like him because he can jump. He's agile. He plays with good energy. But even in today's NBA, I think of him more as a second unit guy. And that is okay, but it's still valuable in the league. I mean, you need all the quality fours you can get. And it's his best spot is at power forward, not at small forward, because you can use his offense better. It's very similar to Aaron Gordon in that way, where his strengths become stronger and his weaknesses become less glaring. So I hope they go in that direction.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he's more of a four than a three. But at the same time, like, the Thunder don't have the luxury of doing that, because they have a decent amount of bigs. They've got four bigs who they play, and they don't have a lot of wings. So they kind of have to use him as a three. I think in an ideal world, like, if they had the exact roster that he wanted, then they would play Jeremy Grant at the four.
And Canner at the five. I think those guys complement each other very well. And you can't do it right now, but generally speaking, I would just cut Joffrey LaVerne, make him the fifth big as opposed to playing in that lineup, because LaVerne's a fine player. He's just unnecessary when the Thunder have the two starting or the two legitimate centers they have.
Right, and he's a little redundant. His skills are a little redundant with Canner's.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's not really that much that Canner does, which LaVerne is going to come in and do better or replace or fill in the gaps or anything like that. Like, you know, Canner and Adams are very different players. Each of them kind of complements in the way that the other one doesn't do, you know? Or I guess Adams is so much more complete now, so it doesn't really fit, but you know what I mean.
To make a football analogy, it's kind of like when you have two different quarterbacks. Yeah, it's great to have both of them, but you can't really play them together. So you appreciate each one of them for what they bring and do that, whereas Adams and Canner, you can play them at different positions. You can fit them in together a little bit, so there isn't that kind of a conflict.
Right, for sure. So what is going to happen with this second unit? The Thunder second unit has been better lately. Last time these two teams played, obviously the Thunder season has developed and the Warriors have, and they've gone through ebbs and flows, but Kevin Durant runs the second unit and the Warriors second unit is real good. What is going to happen with this second unit when Russell Westbrook is off the floor on Wednesday night? Like, what are the Warriors going to do?
The Warriors have actually changed their second unit over the last 2 weeks. It's an interesting shift. They have moved away from Durant running the second unit and moved towards Draymond Green. They basically have flip-flopped their sub-rotation. It happened because of two games where Draymond Green got in early foul trouble, the Cleveland game, and then when they played in Sacramento a couple weeks later. That switch has given Curry and Durant more time together. So Russ usually plays the whole first quarter, correct?
No, or, he comes out. He comes at it around 2 or 3 minutes.
That's right. Okay, so then that time is going to be a real danger spot for the Thunder because Curry and Durant will still be on the floor. Presumably, Draymond and Klay Thompson will be out, but it'll be some combination of Curry, Durant, Iguodala, and whatever big they feel like playing. That unit could go on a little bit of a run at the end of the quarter. The second unit with Draymond instead of Durant, as you would guess, is very talented defensively. A lot of long-armed, smart guys, but they do not have much natural scoring. So I'm not sure they'll put a huge number on the Thunder in that time. It could be an advantage for Oklahoma City compared to what it was last time. Also, I believe that was on the tail end of a back-to-back for OKC. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. It was they played the Clippers the night before.
Right, so they put it on him in that regard as well. I think it'll be a little bit tighter there, but the Warriors also, their offense and defense are both doing better. The barometer for the Warriors this entire stretch, the last 3 or 4 weeks, has been whether they're active on defense. And that doesn't really answer the question of how are they going to do when Westbrook's off the floor, but it does change the tenor of it, because if they're engaged defensively, they can get transition points and everything else. And if they're not, they can let almost any team hang in there. The Pistons came back in the game with their second unit against the Warriors' second unit, and a couple other teams have as well.
Okay, so let's say hypothetically, just for the sake of discussion, Jeremy Grant starts alongside Sabonis in the front court. The Clippers had 62 points in the paint in that game. And like, it's not like it was DeAndre Jordan played really well, but it's not like it was just like DeAndre killing him or other big men killing him. Like, Ray Felton was getting by the guards and getting into the paint, and there was no help. Or, you know, they were getting switches and blown by guards and that kind of, or blown by bigs and that kind of stuff. And they were just getting to the rim whenever they wanted. They shot, I forget what it was. They shot a crazy high percentage in the paint and at the rim. Now, obviously, I think it's safe to say if Steven Adams is there, that either doesn't happen or it happens to a lesser degree, because that's what Steven Adams is really good at. But they're not going to have him on Wednesday night. So if you're the Warriors, how are you trying to take advantage of that?
Two different things at the same time. First is finishing when you have an opportunity. The Warriors have certain players that they don't fear in the lane. Mason Plumlee is one of these, and Mason Plumlee is a better rim protector than a lot of the guys OKC is going to trot out there. Because of that playoff series, the Warriors just don't really care when he's there, so they finish over him, they finish around him. I expect that we'll see some of that as well. But the other part, what makes the Warriors legitimately terrifying offensively, is that they can actually turn dribble penetration into more points than a layup, because they're so good at creating and then making open threes. So I think we'll see some of that as well. A lot of times teams scramble when they see a guy breaking towards the rim, and they'll leave Klay Thompson, they'll leave Kevin Durant, and that can be a real backbreaker, because if it's 3 points, and that's what really gets an Oracle crowd going, other than a highlight layup, is a three by anyone, especially Steph.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how they're going to be able to get to the rim. And I also, like, here's my worry if I'm the Thunder. It's not scoring in the paint. Like, the Clippers got to the paint and scored in the paint. My worry is those drives and kicks. Like, if they're able to get into the paint, the Thunder, what's weird about the Thunder defense is they're pretty high ranked in terms of their efficiency. I forget where they are after the Clippers game, but they're pretty good. Like, they're top half of the league, but they give up a lot of shots at the rim. They give up a higher percentage of their field goals allowed come at the rim than any other team. And they give up a decent amount of corner threes too. And it's weird to see that ratio on a really good defense. Especially considering teams shoot pretty okay against them at the rim too. It's not like teams are shooting incredibly poorly at the rim, like Utah or something like that. They're shooting pretty okay against them. So I'm interested to see what Golden State does if they're able to get into the paint, they're able to get in penetration. When they kick it back out, when they're able to create from the inside and they actually get into that belly, what happens?
Yeah. I mean, so I want to turn this a little bit to ask you is, beyond Russ, who is incredible, how do you see Oklahoma City taking advantage of the Warriors if they use this as a letdown game because of the emotional win they had on Monday?
Can you repeat that?
Sure. So if the, so the, I talked earlier about how the Warriors have had games where they're active defensively and games where they're passive. If this is a passive game, what do you see as the way that the Thunder use that to generate reliable offense?
Probably just being able to get there and get their points in transition. I mean, that's really the Thunder's best weapon offensively. Like Russell Westbrook gets a ton of defensive rebounds. He gets out in the break real quick. And you know, they're able to get points. Like they're really good at getting into transition. They're not really good at scoring in transition once they're in transition, but transition opportunities are so much more efficient than half court opportunities, as you very well know, that even if you're the least efficient, you know, transition offense in the league, that's still more efficient than, you know, any half court opportunity that you're going to have. So them just being able to get into transition and them stopping the Warriors in transition, that's something that's interesting for them. Defensively, they're one of the best transition teams in the league. They don't give a lot of points in transition. They're pretty good at matching up with the correct guys in transition, especially Andre Robertson. He's really good at finding his assignment, which is really important when you can get your best wing guy on, you know, whoever he's guarding, whether it's a point guard or, you know, a big forward or whatever it is. You know, he's really good at picking up the right guy and being able to find that, which is particularly impressive because he often has to guard a person who's not guarding him. Mm-hmm. So it's particularly impressive that Robertson is able to do that a lot. But I think that's kind of their weapon. I don't know if that's necessarily going to happen, but that's really their best chance, I think, against a lot of teams like this, is just to be able to kill him in transition on offense, get out in transition a ton, maybe end up with some transition threes from Oladipo or something like that, and they happen to go down in those opportunities. And then defensively, obviously this is a point against the Warriors every time you play them, but being able to just pick up any man in transition and get back, you know, as well as they've been able to do it. Like, they've had games where they've given up zero transition points a couple of times this year. And on a point-per-possession basis, they're one of the better transition teams. And, you know, even after turnovers, teams are really slow to shoot against them, which shows that they're good at slowing down those transition opportunities. So I think that's the way to do it.
That's a good point. The Thunder have been very active in transition. It's been a bright point for them offensively and as you said, defensively. And the Warriors have not been as zealous, especially in those passive games, at getting back. So if the Thunder can do so, it will certainly help. And I'm skeptical of how they'll do in the half court, just because the Warriors generally engage at that point if it reaches it. But they can get some buckets in transition.
Who do you think? So how do you think the Thunder work their defensive matchups? Because with Adams out, again, let's assume it's Grant. With Adams out, it's a little, because like Robertson, I can envision Robertson guarding Clay. I can envision Robertson guarding Steph. I can envision Robertson guarding Durant. Maybe you want Grant on Durant. How would you go about it?
I'd probably have when the Warriors and Thunder are in their standard alignment. So if Jeremy's playing the four, probably have Robertson on Durant and pray that Russ can just stay at least a little bit with Curry. The Warriors do not run much pick and roll, so you don't have to worry about that, though they are doing more of it since around Christmas is when it really turned around. So that is a possibility. They could dabble with it, but Billy Donovan has in the past also, you know, like if a matchup isn't working, he'll change it up. So I would start with Robertson on Durant. But if you feel the need to change it, at least they have the personnel to try different things.
Right. I think I might start with Grant on Durant. Interesting. I think I might start with Grant on Durant and Robertson on Clay.
What's funny is I'm sure there's a piece of knowledge that both of us don't have that's incredibly pertinent, which is when they played in practice for all that time, how they went after it and how they approached it. You know, if Durant would just use him and like learned all of his defensive things, or the opposite way. A lot of times that practice player, your rival in that, can know all your tricks too. So that piece of information will be crucial.
Well, I asked someone on the team who shall remain nameless, if Robertson would guard KD during practices and stuff. And the person that I asked was not Robertson. And if he thought that would help Robertson in the game. And they said whenever they scrimmage, they would always do first team versus second team. So Robertson and KD were always on the same team.
But that can't have been true forever. Robertson was not a starter for most of his time.
That's true. But yeah, I guess
it was a nice non-answer, though.
That was
very,
a good answer.
A very good non-answer.
Didn't even respond. I don't think the person was trying to trick me. It was kind
No. And you think back usually to the most recent time that question was pertinent.
Right.
So, exactly. You know, the last time that question was pertinent, they were starters, and so they didn't face each other.
Right. That's what I get for being a bad journalist and not realizing that until you just said that.
Hey, you're highly esteemed. It's nothing wrong.
Well, I can ask. I can ask again and then find out. I wonder that it is something that I've wondered too. I wonder how that works. I wonder, like, because Grant guarded Durant a little bit. I think they liked it. Robertson's so good guarding off the ball. Maybe you have Oladipo on. You know, it's so hard because Draymond makes things so hard is the problem. Maybe you have Grant on Draymond just because he's rangy and maybe he can disrupt some passes and stuff. And
Russ likes
to guard Steph too. Like Russ likes to guard Steph.
Another thing to consider with this, especially when you have a younger team, which at this point Oklahoma City is compared to the Warriors, sometimes you want to just also go with what the other team does because then you ensure that you're not going to have these weird split matchups because even though the Thunder, as you said, have been better at figuring it out in transition, when a team runs a lot and you have different assignments on the opposite ends of the floor, you can make mistakes all the time.
Yes. That is very true. And it's something that's one of the things that I'm working on a piece on the Thunder's transition defense. Cause what's interesting is that they're top 10 in offensive rebound rate and they're like top 5 in transition defense. And that's usually not a thing. They're like 6th in offensive rebound rate and 4th in transition defense or something like that. Last time I checked. And, those aren't complementary. Those stats usually have an inverse relationship and it's kind of amazing that they've been able to hold that up. And one of the things that I want to focus on is just the way that they've been able to pick up their guys, even though teams often cross match against them and they often cross match against teams. It's a really interesting thing because you're right. It is. That's hard. And it's even harder when you're going up against a team like Golden State.
True.
Yeah. So anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think so. After the game against the Clippers, do you feel like the Thunder, not only because of the whole Durant thing, which is a little bit overwrought, but just the nature of playing a team that has been a rival for years, will bring out closer to their A level of intensity?
Yeah, I do. I don't know if it'll do them a ton of good, but I do. I think even Russell Westbrook after the Clippers game, like even if he was saying they came out sluggish and like that's fine that they came out sluggish. Second night of a road back to back. They're in the midst of a long road trip. Clippers are 29-14. It's not like they dropped to some bad team at home or something like that. Second night of a road back to back against a 680 team is always an excusable loss. And that's always an excusable situation where like you're going to come out sluggish in some of the 82 games in a year. Like you're,
sure.
Any team you're just going to. Because teams are made up of human beings. And that's an excusable situation to come out like sluggish. It doesn't mean not giving effort. It just means like you're tired because this is an exhausting thing that they're going through right now. I think they'll have it against the Warriors, though. They get the day off. They didn't have a late flight on L.A. Usually teams fly out after the games. They stayed in L.A. and flew out in the afternoon to San Francisco on Tuesday, so it's not like their sleep schedules are going to be all messed up like it often is on road trips. I think they're going to come out and they're going to look better than they did against the Clippers. Now, not having Steven Adams though is just they got to be really disappointed about that.
Certainly, and it can be hard in those moments, like when you know that you're not going to have a teammate to sometimes you get that early rally and then you just go bah. You know, like it's not our night. That could be the story. But I also legitimately don't know whether the Warriors are going to be bringing it because they certainly did the first time. You know, like that was a unifying thing of like, you know, we want to play well in this game. The Thunder were so successful. Were they undefeated or they had one loss at that point?
They were 4-0. They just won at the Clippers.
Yeah, that's right. In that nasty slog of a game.
Yeah.
But
that was one of those like ugly fun games.
Yes.
That was a fun 85-83 game.
Right. So I think that had a different atmosphere. There is an argument to be made that this is, of the three games that the Warriors have during the week of this week, that it is the least central to them, because Cleveland being number one and Houston on Friday being number two. But it still has meaning for these guys, and I'm sure they would love to end this road trip strong. So my current theory of the game is that the Thunder surprise a little bit early, keep it close, maybe even have the lead. And then when Russ comes out, maybe that starts to turn the tide, and then it kind of goes that way in the second half, which has been the Warriors' MO in a couple of games this year, including against Detroit a couple days ago.
And from a personal perspective, it 100% has meaning for Durant.
Absolutely.
Like, no question. He's even, like, he hasn't talked about that recently, but he's talked about playing against, you know, Oklahoma City and what that means to him and all that stuff. I mean, it has personal meaning. And regardless of what the Thunder guys say or don't say, it has personal meaning to them. Because, like I said, they're human beings. And this is a thing. Like, if I had to, even if it's not, like, personal meaning doesn't mean hatred. I'm not even accusing them of hating them. I'm just saying it's personal meaning when you go up against a team that beat you in the Western Conference, in the Western Conference Finals, when you're going up against, you know, Kevin Durant, who's the face of your franchise. Like, that's fine. You can't tell me that these are the most competitive basketball players in the world from an actual personality standpoint. You can't tell me that Russell Westbrook's insanely competitive, and Victor Oladipo and Steven Adams and Enes Kanter, that they're all insanely competitive people, and then tell me, no, it's just another game. Because that's not how competitive people work. Competitive people get hyped up in competitive situations. That's part of what makes them competitive. So I'm not saying they approach it differently. I'm not saying it affects them negatively or positively, but what's going through their minds is something different on Wednesday night, and I won't believe otherwise.
I think you're right.
Anything to plug? Anything to say before we go?
I have my normal standard high volume of material. Do Locked On Warriors, then the Dunked On Basketball podcast with our mutual friend Nate Duncan. No Twitter NBA show this week, which is the live streaming show Nate and I do using Twitter and Periscope. And then my normal writing material. I'm waiting, as I think you are too, for the actual text of the new collective bargaining agreement, because one of my other things is that I'm a CBA nerd. And so once that comes out, I'll have a whole lot more for Real GM, the Sporting News, and everyone else.
I'm waiting for Larry Kuhn's summary. I actually read the last CBA, not all of it, but like a pretty decent amount when it came out. And the whole time it was a horrible experience for me. And I think I might go, like, I'm going to end up reading it this time, but I need to sit down and take a huge deep breath before I do it. It's hard. You're a lawyer, so you're used to that stuff.
Mm-hmm. It is, but I encourage people as well, just because, I mean, obviously I'm not saying like go out the first time and first day and read it or something like that, but just to have it, to get a sense of it, because these will be the rules for the next 7 to 8 years. So whatever you can glean from it, it's fun.
It will give you a massive advantage as a fan if you read that thing, because you are going to know things that no other fans know.
Yeah.
Like when you are trying to, if you're engaged in one-upsmanship with like your best friend or a sibling or whatever it is, like read that CBA and you will one-up them every time you have a basketball conversation.
It also doesn't matter where your team is in the process. The CBA affects everyone. So you have to kind of know the rules, and if you can get to a point where you can know how it affects your team when you're in a given spot. I mean, Oklahoma City and the Warriors both dealt with this over the summer of rapidly changing circumstances. Rapidly changing circumstances are one of the best times when you can fall back on that, because while there are wonderful people who write about this stuff and you can basically take their knowledge, I'm somebody who trusts my own judgment. And so it's great if you can do that for yourself.
All right. So Twitter handle.
Danny LaRue, DannyLeroux.
The LaRoux. You ever get LaRoux?
I get every possible pronunciation of those six letters.
All right, and I'm Fred Katz, FredKatz. I get Kates sometimes, but that's about it. And then people think my last name is spelled Cats. That's the other one. That's going to do it for us. Enjoy the Warriors. Enjoy the Thunder. It should be a fun one. ESPN. late night game on ESPN, so enjoy it. And I'll be wrapping up after the game on Wednesday night for Thursday morning's podcast. Until then, Locked On Thunder is locking up.